smile. Flynn, all that shit you've told me about your life, you've got serious issues, boy. I mean, don't get me wrong. You got issues I can handle, she said with a wink, but issues nonetheless. The doctor gave me a warm smile. Wait, what's wrong with me? I asked. Well, nothing is wrong with you, Flynn. You just have a hyper-attentive mind. I stared at him for a moment. So, what, I have ADHD or something? The doctor laughed. No, Flynn, I didn't say hyperactive. I said hyper-attentive. My guess is you're constantly thinking. You rarely take a break, he said, then lightly tapped his ballpoint pen to his temple. And you're always on the go upstairs. Mia says you put a lot of pressure on yourself to succeed, and the pressure is synonymous with worry, anxiety. It's incredibly common. People just don't talk about it openly enough. He gave me another kind smile. I think you need a few days to yourself, and I recommend you see a therapist. My eyes went wide. A therapist? I'm not crazy. The doctor sat in the chair next to my bed. No one is saying you're crazy, Flynn, but panic attacks are serious. They affect a lot of people without them knowing it or addressing it. There's something that should be looked into. In order to treat them, we must find the source. Treatment can come in many forms. There's cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness exercises, sleep, and Why do you keep saying panic attack? What the hell is that? I interrupted. Well, the doctor explained, a panic attack is an involuntary occurrence that happens in the mind. Wait a second, I said, cutting him off. This wasn't a mind thing, Doc. This was a physical thing. Like, this was my legs giving out and I couldn't breathe, couldn't see straight. This is a feels-like-I'm-dying, life-threatening event here. The doctor looked at me for a moment, his hand placed over his mouth. Then he removed it and spoke. The mind is a very powerful thing, Flynn. If you don't control it, it will control you. I immediately remembered my conversation with Frank regarding the attention I was giving Mia and not him. The thought of Frank increased the anxiety I was feeling. Frank always blathered on some waking life type shit about the power of the mind to create and destroy. What you believe to be completely physical is actually stemming from your mind. It's a concentrated episode of acute anxiety that manifests itself physically, but it is not life-threatening. A panic attack cannot kill you. This is what you experienced, the doctor continued. I've got the test results to prove it. He lifted up his clipboard and pointed at it, as if that were proof. Look, Flynn, just take a few days to yourself. Get your head right and see a doctor sometime. A therapist. It will be good to talk to somebody. In the meantime, I'm going to prescribe Ativan and a... Oh, no, Doc, I interrupted. I don't do pills. Well, then you'll have to white-knuckle through your anxiety, but I am still suggesting you go to therapy. You can leave here whenever you feel ready. Then, just as quickly as he had arrived, the doctor was gone. What's wrong? Mia said to me. I knew it was the look on my face that gave me away, like I was pondering something fierce. Honestly, I said, I just hope this doesn't blow my shot at getting with you. Getting with me? Mia chuckled. What are we, in seventh grade? She moved over and sat next to me in the hospital bed. You want to get with me, Flynn? Well, I stumbled. I mean, like, Flynn, I'm here, aren't I? She interrupted. If you want to get with me, then get with me. She put her hand on my leg, moving in for a kiss. It was absolutely incredible. Her lips were soft as silk. It felt electric. I held the back of her neck. I was suspended in the moment. The fact that she kissed me like it was no big deal. That let me know just how special she was. But even then, in the middle of our kiss, my mind raced, thinking of where this could go, thinking that I was still not fully over Lola, that I wasn't ready to move on, thinking about how Mia had been there for me through this terrifying experience, and then, well, in that very same moment, as my mind raced, as I was in the middle of kissing this beautiful woman, I thought about how spot on the doctor was. My mind truly was hyper-attentive, and I needed to chill the fuck out. Writing this novel was messing with my head. I mean, even in this moment, I wasn't fully present. I couldn't just enjoy something I had fantasized about for weeks. as Mia pulled back from our kiss with a bite to my bottom lip, I looked into her eyes and had one final thought. Maybe I should talk to somebody. Chapter 7, Derealization. And that somebody was Google. Ted Daniels had no problem giving me a few days off to myself. Mental health days, if you will. Honestly, I thought he was going to be a bitch about it, but he was fairly understanding. And those days, I thought a lot about, well, a lot. Essentially, the only time I went outside was to walk Bennett. And the biggest thing on my mind besides my novel, that feeling of not being in my body. It's hard to explain, but the next day when I woke up, I didn't feel quite myself. My mind felt sharp, and yet, at the same time, it didn't. It was the same reason I didn't smoke pot, actually. You see, when I smoked weed, I felt like there was a little person inside my brain watching me live. Did I really just pick up that glass of water and drink it? Did I really just scratch my arm? Did I really just awkwardly look at that person next to me? Did I really just say yeah while shaking my head no? What the fuck was I talking about? Who am I? What even is I? You know, the kind of feeling when you're questioning your own existence. When you know you're real but are not exactly convinced. When you feel barely tethered to reality. That's the reason I didn't smoke. And that's the sensation I had been feeling all the time lately. Now I felt it when I was sober. So as you can imagine, I was alarmed. I wanted to fix myself. I was so sure the doctor was wrong. This wasn't anxiety. This was something else. This felt different. I began constantly thinking all the time, worrying about things I had never really thought about before, you know, like death. Obviously, death is going to happen. It's unavoidable. It is what it is. But then it hit me. Yo, you are gonna die. One day, it'll all be over. And then I got scared because I didn't know when I was going to die. And I began to wonder if there was an invisible ticking clock above my head. Would I want to know the number it was counting down to? Or how? Or why? And it gets worse. When I took Bennett for walks, I would see the world entirely differently. Obviously, at that point in my life, I was scared, flat out petrified. When I was around other people, I wouldn't want to be there anymore. I'd be too anxious to speak. I wouldn't want to give a fake smile as they walked by. Didn't want to try to pretend. I just wanted to stay inside and do nothing. I couldn't even write. It was different than when I was super depressed. My mind was racing, but my thoughts were stuck in the confines of my head, and they couldn't get out and be turned into actions. I had more panic attacks, but now I knew what they were. That didn't necessarily make them any easier to go through, but I could at least intellectually understand that I wasn't dying. Or was I? I would force myself to interact with others, even just the slightest interaction. The anxiety I was feeling was not crippling exactly, but it seemed to hurt more to white-knuckle through than just accept myself as a coward. Even though, as a coward, no one would know I was a coward because I would never have to subject myself to the company of others. Holy shit, this is pretty dark. Even now as I'm writing this, it's sickening to imagine where I was in my life. And not to break the fourth wall again, but in some crazy way, these feelings are kind of returning now that I'm writing about it. I don't want to write about it, but I will because it's part of the process of healing, I suppose. Writing was the only thing that brought me any solace. My creative energy was the same energy that caused my hypermind and anxiety. It was a cycle, a bad loop. Madness and creativity, creativity and madness. Writing was both my salvation and my undoing. I got more pages written, but I got further into my panic. When I was writing, I felt whole, like myself, like a stable person. But the minute I stopped, I started to unravel. To shake it off, I would walk my dog, Bennett. But even then, I would be constantly thinking of death and the various ways to go. For example, when I was a teenager, I used to skateboard. I would skate relentlessly, and afterward, I saw the world completely differently from before I'd started. Stairs were no longer stairs. They were called a set of four I could kickflip down, or a set of 10 to nollie down, a handrail to grind, a loading dock to jump off. The world had become my skate park. Only now, that imagination and awe I had for my surroundings had turned into something else. A horror film. A TV stuck on Fox News. If a car banks this corner, I'm gone, I would think as I crossed the street. If I trip and land teeth first on this fire hydrant, game over. What if there were a tumor in my brain? What if I had an aneurysm? What if that guy at the convenience store wanted to rob the place and I'm the guy who takes a bullet to prove he's not fucking around? Where my life used to be an adventure, I now wondered, how was I going to get through the day? Slowly, uneventful, typical, everyday, mundane errands came bearing death. And these constant thoughts, plus the feeling of being out of my body, ripped from reality, isolated and alone, even in a room full of people. That's what finally turned me on to the idea of actually speaking to someone. And that someone was Dr. Search Engine. Why do I feel like I'm not real, slightly off balance and out of it? In an instant, a slew of results came across my laptop screen. Problems with the blood, problems with the brain, problems with damn near every part of my body. Even though I knew all of this was impossible and the doctor told me my blood results were normal and I felt in my heart it couldn't be life-threatening, I wasn't myself. I didn't feel like I had before the incident at the supermarket. I typed into the search engine, "Feeling out of my body like life isn't real." After some digging, I discovered a condition called derealization. The dictionary results changed everything for me. Merriam-Webster. Derealization. A feeling of altered reality such as that occurring in schizophrenia or in some drug reactions, in which one's surroundings appear unreal or unfamiliar. The American Heritage Stedman's Medical Dictionary. Derealization. The feeling that things in one's surroundings are strange, unreal, or somehow altered as seen in schizophrenia. Oxford English Dictionary. Derealization. A feeling that one's surroundings are not real, especially as a symptom of mental disturbance. I spent hours reading reviews, medical articles, testimonials, and people's personal stories about it. Some people experienced it for a few weeks and it was gone, while others spent years with it. I also discovered that the condition, along with schizophrenia and a host of other mental disorders, is genetic. Fuck, I thought of my dad. How he lost it, left the family, wound up dead by his own doing. I felt a similar fate was inevitable. I felt trapped, shaken to the core. I couldn't focus on anything else. It seemed apparent that derealization fed off attention like a stripper whose father never gave her the time she needed as a developing child. So you see, in other words, the more one focused on how weird they felt, how out of it, how they didn't exist and the world around them wasn't real, the more attention they brought on it, the more they couldn't escape themselves. And the crazy part? The more I read about it, staring at the screen, the more involved and focused I was, and the more focused I was, the more focused I was on something besides what I was feeling. Even though that thing was reading about what I was feeling and why, in those moments, the less I experienced it. For example, when thinking about my book or that big event I had been searching for, I hadn't felt out of my body because I wasn't thinking about my body or the feeling of not existing. And that was the key to overcoming derealization. Essentially, don't think about the pink balloon. Only makes you think about the pink balloon. All in all, in the hours and hours of looking this stuff up, the one thing that made me feel better was learning that feeling that way couldn't hurt me. It was scary, it made me feel uneasy, it was annoying and really fucked with me, but it wouldn't hurt me, and it couldn't kill me. During one of these deep dive research sessions, my old school phone went off. I looked at it, puzzled. It went again. I reached out and pulled the phone to my ear. "Hey man, how you feeling? Ted said you wigged out or something." It was Frank. Before I could even answer, he continued. "So yeah, buzz around the store as you saw Kara's tits." "Who told you that?" I said. "Doesn't matter who, just tell me about them." "They're nice, right?" I guess, I said, wrinkling my brow while recalling the event. Since it had happened, I hadn't thought a minute more about how beautiful her body was. But of course, leave it to Frank to remind me of a woman's naked upper body. As Frank chewed over the phone on what I'm sure was a banana, My mind was thrown back into that instant where I walked in and saw Kara topless. That moment where I froze before either of us frantically reacted. Standing there, back at the supermarket, in my mind, I could picture it all. Her breasts were so supple, her skin smooth and pale, seeming to have no imperfections, no necklace, no markings, no tattoos. No tattoos, I thought. In a fraction of a second, I had both realized something insane and forced myself to forget it for the sake of my book. Frank had said Kara had a cupcake tattoo on her rib. Ever since I met him, Frank had droned on and on about himself, telling me about the girls he'd been with, his pseudo-philosophies, and his take on life. I'd been so fascinated by the sharp edges of his personality, so fascinated that I had based my book on him. But this entire time, he had just been another phony. Frank wasn't real like he claimed to be. He was a liar, and a goddamn good one. At that moment, I realized what he was, or what he wasn't. I could see right through him. I was struck with panic at the thought of what this would do to my book, upset that creating my main character around him was now pointless because there was no authenticity to Frank's words. I no longer knew what was false and what was true. I almost called it off, right there in that moment. I was on the edge of scrapping the whole book until those words echoed again in my head, just as they had that night in my bathroom. That night before I set foot in Muldoon's to fill out that application. Finish the book. Finish the book. Instantly, a maddening vision of failure boiled up inside me. Finish the book. Finish the book. Let nothing stop you. Right then, I got that feeling again, as if I were split in two, just as I had that night in front of the mirror. In that moment, a frozen time, a new me had emerged, filled with determination to complete the task and prove Lola wrong. In that moment, ignorance was bliss. Talking to Frank, my mind just blanked itself to the event. I forced myself to forget his fallacy, instead believing every word he spoke, for the sake of my book's completion. I believed fully in everything he conveyed. I did it so the audience would do the same from page to page. Because how could I sell a book about a womanizing, self-indulgent supermarket employee if he wasn't one? If I didn't believe it, my audience wouldn't. And just like that, the cupcake tattoo was real, both in my mind and in my book. The cupcake was there, and all doubt about Frank's stories was thrown from my mind. And I was inspired again. The writer's block was gone, and I could feel all the things I had to write about coming to me. "Yo, help me fuck Rachel, man," Frank said into the phone. "What?" I replied, feeling energized, feeling the best I had in weeks. "Go tell her your boy Frank likes her. We've never formally met, so it'll be awesome. Like some seventh grade shit," he said. "Okay, for sure, man. Let's discuss it at the store." Frank agreed, and I hung up. After the phone call, I jumped into bed feeling rejuvenated. The first thing that came to mind was Mia. I couldn't help but think of Mia and how beautiful she was. How I missed her, how I wanted to kiss her again. I hadn't seen her in the few days I took to myself, so I was very much so looking forward to seeing her. I thought to myself, I should take her on a date. Tomorrow was the last day I had off before I headed back to work. With that thought in mind, I fell asleep. I woke up feeling great. I asked Mia to meet me at this putt-putt golf spot at 7 that evening for a much-needed date. But I had the whole day until then to do whatever the hell I wanted. I grabbed Bennett's red collar from the top of the dresser and took him on our morning walk. I never left it on him when we were home, figuring it was uncomfortable for him. On my way out, I saw Mrs. Huffle in the stairwell. Like always, she was very sweet and asked how my dog was doing, as if he wasn't right there in front of her. She was kind of batty, really. Like always, people gave me and Bennett super strange looks on our walk. I never understood why. I mean, he wasn't exactly the cutest dog. I guess that was it. Man, people can be so superficial. We walked around, ending up at this park by my house on Bleecker Street. Then we played fetch with the red rubber ball, the same one I bounced thinking of ideas to write. It was nice to just chill with Bennett. I don't know why, but whenever we hung out, I got the same feeling I did when I hung around Frank. I was definitely entertained, I'll tell you that. Later in the afternoon, back at my house, I decided to clean up the place. It was pretty messy, and who knew? Maybe Mia would end up coming back later that night if I was lucky. I had a few framed pictures I had collected in the time I'd been living in the apartment, along with busts and other collectibles, but I'd never found the time to properly decorate the place. Down the street was this awesome store called Blast from the Past. They had all sorts of amazing memorabilia, t-shirts and busts, anything collectible. But the thing they had that was super awesome was their poster selection. I had befriended a guy who worked there named Duncan. He was British and seemed to be of mixed race. He was definitely black, but very light-skinned, super nerdy, but he had a cool vibe about him. I always wondered what the hell he was doing in the States, working at a place like that, but I never asked. I did, however, know he really enjoyed it. Every time I went there, he was pretty stoned. We would talk Star Wars and other fun sci-fi shit. Anyway, it was definitely my favorite place to waste my time. That and Fisher's Vinyl Village. I absolutely love music and vinyl. I mean, even now as I'm writing and you're listening, there's a record spinning next to me. Today's 12-inch of choice is an album called Salad Days by Mac DeMarco. He's one of my all-time favorites. Anyway, I spent the next few hours hanging up posters of my all-time favorite stuff. Futurama, Star Wars, anything Seth MacFarlane, especially the Orville. I had quite the collection. Guardians of the Galaxy, Indiana Jones, Blade Runner, Back to the Future, all that shit. I actually had a blast turning my bland writing room into an author's sanctuary. When I finished, I looked at my watch and did a double take. It was 6:25 p.m. I had to run or I was going to be late for our date. I gave Bennett a loving pat on the head and was out the door. My entire way there, I was beaming. I couldn't wait to see her. By the time I got there, the sun was almost down. There was a beautiful vanilla sky, like God himself painted it just for us. Cheesy, I know, but I must admit the vanilla sky is my favorite sky, full of pinks and creams. It really is quite the sight. No wonder Monet created a masterpiece from it. I was pretty out of breath when I showed up. Mia was sitting on a bench under the huge putt-putt sign, which was lit up, Bobby's Mini Golf. She looked amazing. She was wearing a sexy black slip dress and Doc Marten boots. "Hey there, cowboy," she said with that perfect smile, her lips a dark red color. Swear to God, she spent all her money on Fenty Beauty and Kylie Cosmetics. "Hey there, Jesse," I said, gesturing Wild West pistols with my fingers. "Who the hell is Jesse?" she spit. "Some other bitch you fucking on the side?" "No, no," I said, panicking. "I mean Jesse from Toy Story, you know, because Woody, he meets Jesse when they..." "I'm totally fucking with you, Flynn." "Jesus, man." "Of course she is," I thought to myself. That's why she was so awesome, Mia. Because of shit like that. "Oh, yeah, totally. Anyway, ready to get beat?" I extended my hand and we made our way inside. We had a blast, though, to be completely honest, she kinda sorta severely kicked my ass. I had to get a new ball twice because I kept knocking it into the water traps. The windmills really fucked me up too, but Mia just laughed at me and gave me shit for it. On the second to last hole, she was setting up to putt, and as smooth as ice, I stepped behind her, grabbed her golf club, putting my hands over hers, and hugged her from behind. I nearly cracked up because the move was so cheesy, but I went through with it. "Need some help with your game?" I asked, trying to be smooth. She smelled amazing. "Oh, wait a minute," she said. "I may be mistaken, but wasn't it I who was kicking your ass?" She giggled and gave me a big smile, leaving me weak. "You know," she said, "if I wanted to, I could totally kick your ass from this position." what? I said, tightening my grip on her body just slightly. "Well, my self-defense teacher..." "You take a self-defense class?" I asked, intrigued. "Well, yeah. How else am I supposed to fight off all the hot guys constantly coming on to me?" I'm joking, Flynn. Jeez. "Oh, right. Yeah, totally." "You're such a nerd," she said, chuckling. "It's true. My defense teacher showed me how to fuck somebody up when they are constraining you from behind." "Okay, I'm curious. What do you do?" "Okay, so hold me tight," she said, grabbing my hands. The golf club fell to the ground. She placed my hands around her toned stomach. "Tighter, lover boy. Not scared, are you?" she said, then giggled again. Her ass was at my waist. Shit, I thought to myself. She's so amazing. "I'll show you scared," I joked. With my left hand still holding her stomach, I brought my right hand to her throat in a playful pretend choke.
Oh, now you're talking, Daddy.
Whoa, damn. I'd never had a girl talk to me like this. Certainly not on a putt-putt course.
Jeez, girl. You're kind of a freak, huh?
Maybe just a little one, she said, gripping my hand around her neck.
Punish me, Daddy. I've been bad.
I mumbled, not sure what to say.
Now, she continued, mug me.
What? What do you mean? I asked.
I don't know, man. Pretend you're mugging me. What would you say?
Hey, bitch. Nice, she laughed. Keep going.
Give me all your fucking money.
Crunch time!
Mia screamed as loud as she could. She raised her knee high into her chest and slammed the heel of her boot on my right foot, shooting pain to the receptors in my brain, along with any blood that might previously have been in my penis.
Ah, what the fuck?
I half yelled and half laughed. The pain wasn't excruciating, but it fucking hurt, that's for sure.
Oh, sorry. I tried not to do it too hard. Must be muscle memory.
What the hell, Mia? I said, laughing despite the pain.
Well, in the class, we used realistic dummy legs connected to feet with this bone-like material. That move, if done correctly and with all the force necessary to flee the situation, would have broken all the toes in your foot.
Wait, I said suddenly. Why the hell did you scream crunch time?
Oh, I don't know. The instructor told us to give a war cry whenever we do it. That it would give us more power.
And crunch time came out? I laughed.
I mean, what about hi-ya or some other karate kid shit?
Crunch time sounds like you're doing a real-life Cap'n Crunch commercial.
A what? She asked, moving closer to me.
A Cap'n Crunch commercial, I said, giving her a puzzled look. You know Cap'n Crunch, right?
What the hell is Captain Crunch?
What's Cap'n Crunch? I couldn't fucking believe it.
Mia, you work in a supermarket.
What are you talking about, Flynn? I've never heard of Captain Crunch. It's Cap'n, not Captain, Mia. Let's get it right. And it's a cereal, one of the finest ever engineered. How the hell have you never heard of Cap'n Crunch? What planet are you from? I mean, what cereal did you eat growing up?
One question at a time, damn, she said, laughing. I was poor, remember? All I ever knew was the off-brand cereals.
You're kidding me, I chuckled.
I mean, I've had Sergeant Smash.
Sergeant Smash? What kind of shit is that? I laughed.
Hey, asshole, she said, punching me in the arm. It was pretty good. Actually, better than this Captain Crunch guy, I bet. Cap'n, Mia.
Look, I know we were supposed to get pizza after this, but honestly, I say we go pick up some Cap'n Crunch and head to my place for a taste test.
Whoa there, cowboy, she said. First real date and you're already trying to get me to your place?
Huh? No, I didn't mean it like that,
And of course she started laughing at me and my babbling. I'm just pulling your leg, Flynnigan.
So, taste test? I asked.
I'm so down, she said, giving me that amazing giggle once more. Let's go.
On our way back to my spot, we stopped at Muldoon's to get a cereal medley. Had to put that employee discount to work, all 15% of it. We cruised down the cereal aisle, surveying the scene. Each box loudly vied for our attention, screamed at us, really. Little cartoon characters popped out, threatening us with their sugar-fueled enthusiasm. Lucky Charms, Rice Krispies, Frosted Flakes, Trix, Cocoa Puffs. Poor Sonny the Cuckoo Bird looked like he had just mainlined a speedball.
I'm telling you, Flynn. The generics are just as good, and half the...
I don't want to hear it, Mia. It's time to ball out. Only name brands today. This is the pure shit. Top shelf cereal shopping. I'm about to show you a whole new world. And there it was, near the end of the aisle. Captain Horatio Magellan Crunch, casting his watchful eye over a chaotic sea of competitors. A steady hand among the cereal mascot miscreants. He was always there for me in the mornings. Through good times and bad. It brought me joy to show Mia the wonders of the cereal aisle. The intercom interrupted.
Attention, Muldoon shoppers! We will be closing in 10 minutes. Please select your items and make your way to checkout. Thank you for shopping at Muldoon's, and have a good night.
We grabbed our selections and headed to checkout. Mia got distracted as we passed through the produce section. She brought it to my attention that she was obsessed with pomegranates. The de-seeding was rewarding to her, and the pop of the seeds was exhilarating. She shuffled the pomegranates, disrupting the precarious pomegranate pyramid. A few fell to the ground. I bent down to pick them up, and as soon as I stood up, my heart stopped. It was Lola, pushing a cart our way. Fuck! I panicked. I hadn't seen Lola since the diner, and I wasn't trying to see her now. Mia, let's get out of here. The store's about to close, I said.
Chill, Flynn. We work here, and I need to find the perfect pomegranate, she said.
Mia, let's go. I'm hungry, I said, pulling her forward with my arm.
Flynn, Jesus, okay.
I rushed us to the express lane, 10 items or fewer, hoping to get the hell out of there before running into Lola. I grabbed a copy of People. Brad and Angelina were going to trial over custody. Kanye was doing some Kanye shit. Bieber and Baldwin seemed built to last. I loved People. I emptied my basket of cereal onto the conveyor belt and tossed the magazine on top of the pile.
Flynn?
I stared dead ahead, petrified by the voice coming from behind.
Flynn, is that you?
I turned around.
Lola!
Hey! Hi, I said, my voice shaking.
What's up? How you been?
She said.
I'm great. Everything good with you?
I said.
Yeah, I'm moving to Portland in a couple months, she replied.
That's great. I didn't know what to say. I was feeling twisted, confronted by an intense array of emotions, unable to process any of them. Anxiety, fear, attraction, resentment, happiness, sadness, anger. She was gorgeous, but she was cast in a new light. She was no longer mine. I missed her, but I was trying to move on. Mia pressed my elbow with hers, acknowledging the awkwardness of the situation.
You sure got a lot of cereal there. Is that for dinner?
Lola said with one eyebrow raised.
Yeah. No, I said. Hi, I'm Lola. Who are you?
She asked, turning to Mia.
I'm Mia.
This a new girlfriend, Flynn? Lola said.
Don't worry about it, I said.
Fuck, what the hell was I supposed to do?
I see.
What's new? Lola asked.
How's the novel coming?
I panicked. I hadn't even told Mia about my novel.
Novel?
Mia said. It's going, I said as the cashier told me my total.
$18.95 with your discount, Flynn.
Discount? You work here, Flynn? Lola said, now with both her eyebrows raised.
Yeah, it's for my...
Mia handed the cashier a 20, pulling me by my waist.
Lola, nice to meet you. We're running late and are in a bit of a hurry,
Mia said, pulling me away.
Okay. Good luck with all that, Flynn,
Lola replied. I grabbed our groceries. The white plastic met my sweaty hands. My vision became speckled with spots of white light. My chest tightened.
Flynn, we'll talk in the car, Mia said on our way out of the store.
We pulled out of the parking lot. I didn't know what to say.
I'm sorry that I had to go down like that, Mia.
Flynn, it's fine. It happens. Exes keep living lives. Run-ins happen. You never said anything about a novel.
Mia, you're amazing. Thank you for understanding. I was caught off guard by the whole thing. Look, at one point I was fooling around with some writing. It was just a juvenile hobby.
There's nothing more to it than that, I said.
That's cute. I didn't know you were creative in that way. I want to read some, Mia said.
Oh, no, I said. That stuff is long gone, buried deep in a landfill somewhere. It's for the best.
Well, you should keep writing, Mia said. I think it'd be good for you. Could be a sort of therapy.
I'll think about it, I said. The drive home was strange. That was a roller coaster. It was crazy how sweet and understanding she was about the whole thing, how she saved me from the nightmare situation. That was grace under fire. We sat in silence for the rest of the drive, windows down, with the radio faintly playing in the background. We got back to my place, and I had like 5 different kinds of Cap'n Crunch set up for her to try. My record player was spinning Someday by the Strokes. Bennett was being shy, I guess. He stayed in the room the whole time, avoiding us. On the table, I had the original Cap'n Crunch. I had the one with crunch berries, cosmic crunch, cinnamon crunch, chocolatey crunch, and my personal favorite, peanut butter crunch. She tried them all and fell in love. She was an instant convert. We had a blast staying up for hours, talking about life and the future and everything each of us wanted. Turns out we both wanted kids. We both believed in a higher power of some sort, but weren't super religious about it. Though neither of us judged others who had those beliefs. We went deep about our shaky childhoods, about growing up with low resources, about our fucked up dads, about feeling directionless but ambitious at the same time. We both appreciated what we had in life but wanted so much more. She dreamed of passing the bar and joining a firm in New York City. I wanted to tell her about my New York experience, but I held back. I couldn't let her know I had a book deal. Maybe I would tell her after it was actually finished. Surprise her. After an amazing night, I walked her home. We held hands the entire way. It was a bit chilly out, so I gave her my bomber jacket to wear on the way. Once we arrived at the bottom of the stairs that led to her front door, I grabbed her other hand and pulled her close. Thanks for an amazing night, Mia.
Are you kidding me? Thank you, Flynn. I can't remember the last time I had this much fun with a close friend.
Close friend? I said, trying not to stutter.
Close, but I thought we...
I'm just fucking with you. Come here, she said. Then she leaned in and kissed me. It was amazing, even better than our first kiss, because this time I was completely present and in the moment. I wasn't thinking about anything, not Frank and how he wanted me to set him up with Rachel, not walking in on Kara, not dumbass Curtis, not my anxiety, not panic or derealization or the pressure I'd been putting on myself to finish the book, and especially not Lola. All I thought about in that moment, all I cared for, was Mia. I pulled her closer, her chest pressed into mine. She bit my lip. I gently pulled her hair back and moved my hand to the small of her back. She leaned against her door and raised her leg to my waist, her dress falling back to reveal the length of her thigh. I looked down to see the edge of her black lace underwear. I gently put my weight into her as she thrust her waist forward. Her tongue entered my mouth. She pulled back from the kiss.
Damn, Daddy, she said with a smirk.
I looked at her, flustered.
I want to buy combat boots with you.
What? Why?
Because I want to kick the world's ass together.
It's a deal, she said, shaking my hand. We parted ways and I went home to get some sleep. The next day at Muldoon's, things were as dull as they had been since I started. It had been about a month now. What a brutal come down after last night. The same old, balding, white-haired, frail customer holding that cup of coffee over his nose, inhaling and saying, "Coffee, coffee, coffee, coffee," then repeating it over and over and over again. By now, I just named him Coffee Joe, or Joe for short. I saw Anne, who worked in the pharmacy, and just like always, she insisted on making me take multivitamins in the morning. Like every other day, she would go out of her way to find me at pretty much the same exact time, then force them upon me with a smile. Of course, there was lovable Rhonda, who worked in the front customer service area, Day-Day, who had been working on replacing a fluorescent light near produce, and Curtis, the green-haired deli dick who seemed to hate everyone. Lately, he'd been claiming someone had stolen his silver Zippo lighter from his locker. As he passed me, he insisted that I had been the culprit. There was Ted Daniels, still greeting customers with his yellow teeth protruding from his smile. Then there were Hector and Vernon, who would be coming for pickup that very day. It felt like Groundhog Day around here. Same shit, different day.
Yo, come here, dude.
And then there was Frank, of course, standing by aisle 9. When I caught up to him, he was grinning.
Dude, Rachel is in the break room right now. I need you to do this for me.
I mean, look, I'll do what I can, I told him. But being the ladies' man you are, why don't you just go ask her yourself? Just then, the lights on this side of the store went extremely dim.
Whoa, what the fuck? I said. Goddamn lights again, man. This place is falling apart, said Frank with a smirk.
Day-Day to the electrical box. Day-Day, your assistance is needed at the electrical box.
came a voice from the intercom. A disgruntled Day-Day headed in that direction.
Dumbass white people, he muttered as he went. Don't want to spend the proper money on shit, so a nigga gotta go get the ladder and climb his ass up to the top of that shit and fix the lights. Always calling Day-Day, and Day-Day gotta be all, yes, massa, be right there, massa. I'd have killed these white niggas.
Make sure you videotape it for me, baby,
Rhonda shouted to him. It seemed like she was kidding, but then again, I never really knew. See, man, this is why there's a gun in my locker. You never know what a crazy person is capable of. Shit, he might try to shoot my ass right here in aisle 9, Frank said, half joking. What the hell is wrong with you, man? You know what's wrong with me? I need to get laid. Now go ask Rachel for me, okay? I don't understand why you just won't ask her yourself, Frank. Damn, I told him, a bit pissed off. Bro, we've been through this. I'm trying to take a different approach. Rachel is a smartass, and I'm trying to bypass that side of her, you know? Play a little hard to get. Tug at those heartstrings, fam. Frank paused and gave me a look that said, do you feel me? There was silence for a moment. I just don't understand why you play these games with women. I mean, Rachel isn't exactly a nun. I'm sure if you went up to her and were honest and clear about what you wanted, it would work out. Tell her you want a good time. No strings attached, especially heartstrings. Be straight up. I think she would be about it, man. Frank snagged a banana from produce and began to peel it. Bro, you're thinking way too much into this. Just do me this solid and go tell her your boy Frank likes her, okay? I was tired of trying to reason with Frank. He wasn't a reasonable dude. I decided to just get this shit over with and move on with my day. With that, I was on my way. I reached the break room, and sure enough, Rachel was there. Only this time, she was not accompanied by Becca. She was completely alone. Hey, I said to her.
Hey, Flynn,
she said in a tone that said she didn't give two shits about engaging in a conversation with me. She was reading Cosmopolitan, her lips red as ever and her hair darker than Frank's sense of humor. Look, a buddy of mine wanted me to tell you that he likes you. Her face was hidden by the magazine. 26 sex tips that will bring him to the edge was printed in bold on the corner of the cover. She lowered the magazine, revealing dark eyes beneath her bangs.
Oh, you have a friend, huh? She said as she set the magazine down.
Her mouth curled into a smile. She stood up and walked over to me. She was close, almost too close. Even in her dorky store uniform, she looked fine as hell.
Yeah, my buddy, his name is Frank. She stared at me, puzzled.
Oh, okay, she said, seeming a little let down.
Yeah, he works in the store, I said. Do you guys spend a lot of time together? She asked.
Oh, yeah, well, at work anyway.
So this Frank, how old is he?
I thought for a moment. About my age, I said, grabbing a paper cup on top of the water cooler. Look, either way, he wanted me to tell you that he's into you and you guys should hang out sometime. Maybe grab a bite. Rachel bit her lip.
Fuck it. Why not? She said.
She ripped part of a page from her magazine and scribbled down her number. She put her hand on my elbow and looked up at my face, surveying my features.
You have pretty eyes, Flynn.
You look like a tortured artist, she said.
Thank you? I said.
Tell him to call me, she said, handing me the scrap of paper. Then she walked out of the room. I looked at the number and put it in my right pocket. I couldn't help but feel a bit annoyed that I just did Frank's job for him. But I was also a little turned on by the whole encounter. Just then, Mia walked into the break room.
There's my boy, she said with a smile.
Hey, I said, feeling guilty for having another woman's number in my pocket. Even though it was for Frank. How will I explain this to her if she finds out, I thought. Anything I said would sound like total bullshit.
What were you and Rachel talking about? She asked.
What? Who? I said. She looked at me suspiciously.
Rachel, the cashier? She just left the room smiling. What were you two talking about?
Oh, shit, I thought to myself. When she walked in the room, it was all peaches, except for me acting as though nothing had just happened between me and Rachel. My posturing had unintended consequences,
Now Mia was thinking something was in fact happening. Maybe I should just tell her about the whole thing.
What are you, fucking stupid? Frank's voice said in my head, like some funny angel and devil scenario. She's gonna call bullshit immediately.
The voice was right, but I didn't want to lie to her.
Flynn, Mia said, a confused smile on her face.
Sorry, baby. I was literally here daydreaming. Now that I think about it, Rachel was trying to say hello or something, but I didn't even notice. She must have been laughing it off on her way out.
Mia looked at me and I felt horrible for lying, but it wasn't like I did anything wrong.
And just like that, she let it go.
Listen, I had such a blast with you last night, she said. I was thinking maybe round two tonight?
I knew I should work on my book, but at the same time, so much had been going on that I felt I deserved another night to myself.
Okay, that sounds like fun.
It's settled then.
I'll see you soon, she said, departing with a kiss to my cheek.
Chapter 8. Disappearing Dog. It had been a crazy few days. My anxiety had been ebbing and flowing. I was falling hard for Mia and trying to embrace that beautiful feeling, but I wasn't getting anywhere with my novel. I still couldn't figure out how to end the book with a bang, which was nagging at me. It's always something. Frank was being Frank, a burden, a friend. I couldn't quite tell which. The Lola run-in fucked me up, but Mia saved the day and kept me from unraveling into what would have surely been a full-blown panic attack, or worse yet, a spell of derealization. Things at Muldoon's were fine. I finally felt like I had my bearings straight. I'd spent enough time in each department to have the lay of the land. I wasn't making as many mistakes. Today, I was in the refrigerated section, taking care of inventory. Shit was cold in there. I was rocking earmuffs, a scarf, and gloves. It was the section behind the glass when you reach in for your fancy-ass almond milk, or oat milk, or cashew milk, or hemp milk. There were more foo-foo milks these days than I could count. What happened to the classic cow shit? I ran into Frank while restocking. I told him everything. The conversation between me and Rachel, and even Mia walking in and how it must have looked.
People see what they want to see, man. You should know that better than anyone else, Frank said.
What do you mean by that? I asked, wrinkling my face.
I mean, Mia's insecurity was giving her a suspicion that something was going on, so she prodded. Then she let it go because regardless of what was happening before she walked in that room, she has no reason not to trust you.
It's perfect, Frank smiled.
Wait, why is it perfect? I asked, confused.
Because you got Rachel's number, man. Now let me see it, he said, eager to hold it in his hands.
I reached in my left pocket, pulled out the torn magazine page with the number on it, and handed it off for him to do with as he pleased.
I'm gonna call her tonight. Meet me on the roof in 5 for a smoke.
And Frank was off. I grabbed an Arizona iced tea and headed up to meet him. On the roof, I looked out over the other side, opposite where there was the loading dock and endless trees. On this side, I faced the dreary parking lot and the rest of our shopping center. The record store, the bank, the dry cleaners, and of course, the diner where Lola had left me. Reminded of Lola, I took out my wallet and stared at the picture of us. I felt bad. I was into Mia, and keeping a picture of my ex in my wallet? That just couldn't be healthy. But I couldn't bear to let it go quite yet. I don't know why. I just didn't feel ready. As I contemplated it, I could hear the flick of Frank Zippo.
Beautiful day, he said.
I turned around to him sparking a cigarette.
Even in this shitty little town, we still get some breathtaking views, he said.
Now that I thought about it, it was beautiful. It had been raining for weeks and I hadn't realized the sun was finally out. But then again, with all the shit on my plate, finishing a novel and trying to forget about the pink balloon that was derealization, it was hard to notice what was going on right in front of me sometimes. As Frank snapped the lighter shut, I realized something.
Hey, hasn't Curtis been looking for his lighter? I asked, and Frank smiled.
Yeah, I guess so, huh?
You swiped it?
Yeah, fuck that guy, Frank said.
Frank, you aren't that evil. What if it's important to him?
Fuck Curtis and fuck everybody else who works in this godforsaken hellhole. I'm corrupt, Flynn. Just face it. You know it's true,
he smiled. Somebody's got to be the evil villain, but deep, deep down, I'd like to think there's a good man in there somewhere. He's an elderly black man named Billy. Oh, come on, Frank, you should really give it back. It may be more significant to him than you know. I mean, even if he is an asshole. Frank smirked and lit another cigarette. What greater meaning could that asshole's lighter have when it's engraved with the words Vanilla Sky? He either loves Paul McCartney or is gay for Tom Cruise. He gave a heavy laugh. When Frank and I talked like this, it really felt like the conscious and subconscious were battling, the angel and the devil on the shoulder. I suppose that was just Frank, though. He was the guy who said all the shit most people only thought about. That was part of why I loved him and hated him. Maybe he filled out a part of me I wish I had more of. The irreverent, unabashed, anti-authoritarian. It's funny how you can have so many perspectives inside one person. How you can feel like one person one day and another person a different day. But Frank was also an annoying asshole who treated women with little respect and stole from his employer. I'm no goody two-shoes, but I have a conscience. Once again, I pulled out my notebook to take note of all this, and it occurred to me why he was perfect for my book. Frank was a guy who just didn't give a fuck, or at least didn't give a fuck about what other people thought, their rules and regulations. That's what most people wanted. He was saying, fuck morality. He was an anti-hero of sorts. Frank kept talking, going on with his graduate seminar and philosophy ramblings, talking about the beauty behind the madness, saying that without destruction, blood, and pain, life just wasn't any fun. He was a nihilist, he claimed. The world was without meaning. He was a hedonist, he said, a pure pleasure seeker, and he didn't care about the moral rules broken to get it. He didn't seem ever to show a crack in the facade, a vulnerable side, a weakness. That made me suspicious. How can you appreciate the things you have if you've never experienced loss? He said. It was this kind of reasoning that made me understand the thought process behind taking the lighter from Curtis. If Curtis didn't mourn over the lost artifact, he wouldn't appreciate the next one that came his way. At the same time, I told Frank that maybe Curtis already experienced mourning over an item or person he had lost in life. Maybe that's why he was so bitter and seemed to hate everything, and maybe because of that, it was the lighter that he appreciated more than anything. This inanimate object with more meaning to it than Frank or I could even begin to comprehend. Yeah, Frank said. Or maybe it's just a fucking lighter, he laughed. But I didn't. Sure, I thought Curtis was a clown. But I wasn't going to take his shit from him. Why do you even care about that dude, man? You know he wants to fuck your little girlfriend. I turned quickly to him. Wait, what do you mean? Well, why do you think he hates you so much? Always giving you mean looks? Dude, he's had a crush on Mia forever, man. I just stared at him. Look, man, I finally said. Regardless of any of that, the lighter isn't yours. All right, I'll put it back in his locker, Frank said. I smiled as Frank took a drag. He exhaled a full plume, clouding the length of his body. Check it, he said, taking his hand out of his pocket. Jesus, Frank, I said. A stack of hundreds sat in his hand. $5K right here. I've been taking bills from Muldoon since day one and they ain't said shit. They're obviously not feeling the hit, or else I'd be hearing about it. And they pay us garbage. We need it more than they do. I'm barely making rent over here, he said. He pointed to two figures on the ground below. They were leaving the store and approaching an armored truck. It was Vernon and Gary with their deposit bags. You know I could rob this place blind, he said, eyes squinting to evade the sun. I've been here long enough. Bro, you've been robbing this place blind, I said. Like, I'm not talking petty cash from the register. I'm talking the whole shebang, he said. I know how to get in that safe, and I know how to erase the security footage so they would never know. I wouldn't have to worry about fingerprints either. I don't have any. I'd take the money and dip to Canada. Shit's easy living up there, and they'd never find me. I pulled out a toothpick from the box in my pocket and placed it in the left corner of my mouth. What do you mean you don't have any fingerprints? I asked. Frank smiled. Our fingerprints are all over the store. They wouldn't be able to prove it was us, even if they suspected it. Trying to use that to convict us would be pointless in a place like this. What do you mean, us? I said, adjusting the toothpick with my tongue. This isn't Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I'm speaking figuratively, obviously, not us, dude, he said, motioning his hands between me and him. It only needs to be one person.
And like a ton of bricks, it hit me, that eureka moment I had been waiting for. The climactic moment in Muldoon's would be a store robbery, and Frank would be the culprit. It was perfect. Frank actually was a petty thief. He talked big shit about robbing the store blind, but I didn't actually believe he would do it. That's 20 years in prison. But my fictionalized Frank, the exaggerated Frank, he actually would. What a brilliant way to peak my novel.
Frank flicked his cigarette off the roof.
Let's head in. I'm getting cold, he said.
We climbed down the fire escape, onto the loading dock, and past Curtis, who was also outside smoking, looking as disenfranchised as ever. He just wouldn't quit. Maybe Mia really was the reason Curtis seemed pissed off all the time. Maybe he was only angry around me because he could sense our chemistry. But the last thing I was worried about was Monster Energy Curtis stealing my girl. Dude probably went to pickup artist classes. If we were taking bets on who would shoot up Muldoon's, my money was on Curtis. That Arizona went right through me and I needed to piss like a racehorse. I told Frank to wait outside the bathroom. After the much-needed release, I walked to the sink to wash my hands. I stared into the mirror. Tortured artist. I wasn't seeing it. I did have some dark circles under my eyes, though. Maybe I needed some sleep. I splashed my face with water and smiled into the mirror. You're going to finish your book. You're going to finish your book. It's time. I kept saying it almost as if I couldn't believe it myself. Couldn't believe the content I had ready to put on paper. As I walked out of the bathroom, I immediately noticed Frank had left. I headed off to look for him just as Curtis walked back in from smoking.
Hey, have you seen Frank? I asked him.
No, fuck off, he said seriously.
Shrugging him off, I continued on my way past the aisles near the back of the store. I was excited to get off at 6 o'clock, which was not far away. I looked down the aisles for Frank, only to spot Rachel's friend Becca. I gave a wave. She returned the gesture, smiling sweetly, and continued on her way. As I arrived at the end of the aisle, I realized I was in the bakery. I looked behind the counter and saw Mia. She was so beautiful in her white apron, her hair tied up in a ponytail.
Oh, hey, Flynn, she said with a beaming smile. Couldn't wait until later to see me, huh?
Can't wait, I said. Hey, have you seen Frank around here by any chance?
Nope, haven't seen him.
When are the three of us going to hang out, by the way? I spend all my time in the bakery, so I don't get to know anyone else who works here.
It would be nice to meet your friend you always talk about.
The truth was, I hadn't formally introduced Mia to Frank because he had no manners. It was guaranteed he would offend, outrage, or disgust her. I also couldn't admit to her that I was writing a book, not just yet. And the book was the only reason I was continually and willingly subjecting myself to Frank's presence. It was all to get this novel finished. I needed this bullshit artist to keep the inspiration going for my main character. But even deeper still, there was the fact I was actually growing to enjoy Frank's energy. His outlook. It was infectious. It made you not give two fucks about what others around you thought. I was so wrapped up in my own head and my own creative pursuits that this whole vibe was liberating. To live free and think what you want, say what you want. I turned to Mia with an excuse about not introducing her to Frank.
I just like to keep work and love separate, I said.
Flynn, are you saying you love me? She said, blushing.
Oh, no, I meant life, not love. I'm not saying I
stopped myself not wanting to insult her further.
I mean, not that I won't or couldn't. I just, well...
Mia let out another laugh.
Flynn, I'm just fucking with you. I mean, I really like you, but falling in love in just a few weeks isn't exactly realistic, especially considering we haven't spent enough time together to do so.
I felt relieved, though honestly, I knew I was falling for her. I was just glad she was so level-headed. The great thing about Mia was that she never played games. She was always honest about how she felt.
Oh, got it. Well, thanks anyway. I'll see you tonight at the...
Floater!
Interrupted a voice. It was painted thickly with a Russian accent.
Floater, what are you doing here now?
It was the soul destroyer Bianca, come to wreak havoc on my moment with Mia. Oh, hey, Bianca, I was just...
Leaving? Just leaving, yes?
My eyes widened and Mia's rolled. By the way, my name's Flynn, I said.